Hey y'all, just a quick note before we get started today, since I forgot to mention it at the top of the show. This episode includes interviews with Garrett Hedlund, who you know from projects such as Tron Legacy, Triple Frontier, Four Brothers, so on and so forth, and also Scoot McNairy, who you know from Argo and Narcos and Halt and Catch Fire. So stay tuned at the end for that, and I hope you guys enjoy the show. Peace.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man.
Okay, hello, hello, and welcome to the Post-Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at RoBible.com. Today, I am joined by my co-host, Cade Onder, free agent on the market. You could read him at Twitter, at Cade_Onder. And his email is CadeOnder0@gmail.com.
You got it.
There you go. So, it's been a couple weeks. 6 weeks, I think. We haven't chatted since Dune 2. Cade's been on the job hunt. I was in Europe for a couple weeks. And I feel like it was generally kind of slow in March in terms of stuff coming out. I mean, I feel like between Dune and Civil War, you go to the theaters more than me.
Yeah. So
what have you seen this past month?
I saw Godzilla and Kong.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Forgot about that. Wow,
that was okay. That was that, like,
yeah, fun. Yeah. I've heard it's pretty, pretty fun, but I haven't heard any like in terms of how it did at the box office. So
I think it did fine.
Yeah,
like, it was fine. And then I saw Monkey Man,
Omen,
which was pretty good, and the first Omen. I really, really, really liked first Omen.
Yeah,
like, surprisingly, because I didn't even know it was coming out. Like, I had heard, you know, probably at some point that they were doing a new Omen, but I was like, oh, that's gonna suck ass. Whatever, forget about it. And then, like, the week it came out, I was like, yeah, all right, and something to do, and it was really good.
What was the third one?
Monkey Man.
Oh, yeah, and I heard that was eh.
Yeah, I think it got too caught up in the, it's like Indian John Wick thing, because it's not. Like,
right.
it has action, and the action is John Wick-esque, I guess, but it is not, like... I don't know if I'd even call it an action movie. There's so much
really?
In the movie that's
because
just
they
like
basically like the one scene that they sold it on was that fight scene in the kitchen.
Yeah. And like I don't know. It's fine. Like it's just not what I expected from it either. And I think a lot of people were also probably pretty surprised to find out it's not it is an action movie because it has like crazy action, but it's like the very beginning for one bit and then like the very end, but like the entire middle is just him like building himself up, but it's not really an action movie in that second half, really.
Do you think
that middle half
do you think Dev has a
oh holy
Jesus.
Shit,
do you think Dev has a promising directorial future?
Yes, I do. I think circumstances probably, you know, with Netflix getting rid of that movie and all sorts of stuff, and then Peele being like, let's put it in theaters, and having someone like that in your corner.
I was gonna say
really
though
helpful.
Like compared to the reaction I've seen from fans, it's kind of wild that Peele like really ride it or died for this one. Not ride or die, but you know, saved himself.
Right.
He was like,
yeah.
Oh, I've got to do something about this.
Because what I thought had happened was Peele saw it and like it was like, oh, this is going to Netflix. I have to make sure that doesn't happen. But I guess Netflix was not a fan of some of the themes in the movie because it's like very political for like India's politics and culture mm-hmm. and stuff. Mm-hmm. And they weren't jiving with it, so they're like, we don't really want anything to do with this anymore. And so Peele was like, well, I'll do something about it and get on the soapbox for it. But I do think Dev Patel has the juice. He should and will hopefully direct more stuff. I think this is a promising start to his career.
Yeah, I wonder what it'll do for his James Bond chances as well.
Who knows? Who knows? I don't even know if we're getting a James Bond for the next 5 years at this point. Like, the way they always talk about it is so bizarre.
B has been banging that drum for years.
I do think that's probably not a name I would have really thought about up until I saw this movie, but I was like, you know what? I can see it.
But most recently you saw Spider-Man in theaters. Now, anybody who's tuned into this podcast or knows you knows that that's like your favorite thing, right? Like your favorite character.
Yeah, so absolutely.
You were 2 years old the first time it came out, right?
I would have been one and a half.
One and a half. So it goes without saying that you've never seen it in theaters before. Correct. I was trying to think back. I certainly don't remember seeing it in theaters. I would have been 9 when the first one came out, but I definitely remember seeing the second one in theaters. Mm. And it's playing right at my local spot. And I looked when they extended it, because they extended it to Wednesday, I think. And they were pretty much largely sold out immediately. And then I looked at Spider-Man 2 next week, and that's kind of the same thing. Like, there's still a few seats left, but if I'm going to go, I've got to decide like now. So it goes without saying that this was your first time seeing it in theaters. I'm sure it was packed. Why don't you tell us all about that?
Yeah, it was completely sold out. And I drove to my girlfriend's house in Michigan to do it.
From where to where? Like, from what's, was it a city that you had to see it in, or just like a normal ass town?
Yeah, Grand Rapids. Oh, okay. Which is like 30 minutes away from where she lives. Yeah, so... yeah, I went there because they weren't showing it in Des Moines where I live. I would have had to go to Cedar Rapids, which is like 2 hours from me. And I was like, well, I could just make like a whole thing out of it and just see my girlfriend and stuff.
Did she go with you? Yeah.
And this is her second time seeing the movie. I just showed it to her for the first time, like when we started dating a few months ago. And she was like, it's kind of weird seeing a movie I've seen before in theaters. And she got the ick from all of the nerds dressed as wrestling Spider-Man. Like, there were so many people just specifically in the wrestling.
I've seen that
outfit
all over the place. That's disgusting. Hey, it's homemade. It's affordable. She got the ick. I mean, hey, look, that's what you sign up for with these type of screenings. I wonder if it was like that everywhere. Like, what percentage of the crowd would you say was costumed? 15, 20?
Maybe like 5 to 10. Like, it was, it wasn't, it didn't feel insignificant. Like, there was like,
the ick. That's such a Gen Z term.
She was like, if you did this, I wouldn't probably date you. And I said, you know what? That's fair. I'm not a costume person, but I respect the atmosphere. I like the energy of a big crowd.
But you
excited.
Said she streams. So like, she's adjacent to the, like, Comic-Con world. It's not like she's unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, she's really obsessed with this game Overwatch. Uh-huh. And she turned to me at one point, and that scene in Times Square when they're at that big festival and Mary Jane's wearing that like Chinese looking dress.
Yeah.
She turned to me and she said, oh, that looks like the dress that this character in Overwatch wears. And I said, you're calling me the fucking nerd. You're over here thinking about your stupid fucking game while we're watching a movie. But it was a good time.
Enough about her. Tell me about your
fuck
experience.
Her. it was so great. I mean, the moments, hearing the music, you know, kind of cue up as the Columbia Pictures logo pops up on the screen, and it kind of had that grain, that film grain to it and stuff. And it just
35 millimeter.
It wasn't 35 millimeter where I saw it.
Okay.
But it just had that texture to it because, you know, it was shot on film. And it just immediately brought tears to my eyes. Like, I know that shit so fucking well. And I was just sitting there in the theater like, I can't believe
that's incredible.
I am watching, like, the first movie I ever remember watching is Spider-Man on DVD. I stole it from my neighbor's house as a baby. I stole it, and I still have it.
Actually, I think I'm going to pop that in today.
And I was just so over the moon about. Nice. Oh, yeah, that's the one I have too.
I've got the whole trail.
Hell yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. But I just was like, for so long, I've been like, oh, I wish I could see this movie in a movie theater. And I finally got to have that experience. And it was everything I could have wanted. Everyone was so engaged by it.
Hmm.
And
I wonder if there was anyone in there seeing it for the first time. Like, let's say
I saw a kid there, a little kid.
So I was gonna say, like, let's say I'm 40, right? Or
yeah,
let's say I'm 40. I've got a kid now. My kid was just born at the age I'm at now, so 30. Now I'm 40. If I'm like, I'm kind of like this is kind of the perfect place to get him started, you know?
Yes, absolutely. I saw a little kid there, and I wouldn't put it past them for that to have been their first experience. Side note, I saw the Dark Knight trilogy in 70mm IMAX, like a big marathon in 2019, and I sat next to a kid who hadn't seen any of them the first time.
Wow.
That is one of my favorite movie-going experiences because, you know, that very first movie, all the bats appear on the screen at the very beginning and form the logo, and it's really, really freaky. The kid was really scared. Like, he was freaked out by that movie, understandably
yeah,
so.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, I could see
he
that.
Was yeah. extremely young, and by the end, Dark Knight Rises, when he's fighting Bane, the kid was, like, borderline jumping out of his seat. He was so excited. He's like, yeah, Batman, get him! And I'm like, this is, like, the full-blown arc of Bruce Wayne going from scared kid to, like, triumphance and taking on his demons. And I was like, this is so cool. This wow, is so cool.
Yeah, wow, that's cool.
But yeah, it was just a really great experience. And I was really, like, I guess I never noticed the sound watching at home, but having, like, full-blown surround sound in this movie was really awesome, hearing all the whoosh, whoosh, and just the little details. It sounded great. It looked great. I tweeted about how when that bomb explodes in Spider-Man's face at the end when he's getting his ass kicked, like, the entire theater just turned completely fucking orange. Like, it was so bright and it was so cool. Yeah, like, I was
seeing that'll scare the shit out of a kid.
Yeah, I bet. I didn't see where the kid was afterwards, but I mean, I that movie is pretty freaky.
Man, it sticks with you.
Yeah.
I'm curious because I rewatched the Spider-Mans recently because they're so great. But so I think visually they've held up. Held up. Pacing wise, isn't it like a different genre entirely? Like, can you imagine a comic book film today earning itself in the way that this film does? I can't. Maybe the Batman. But still, you show up and he's Batman. So yeah.
Yeah, it's a while before he becomes Spider-Man, like, proper. I would say it's probably close to the halfway point in the movie. And it's even a little bit longer than that before he and Green Goblin fight. Like, he doesn't have a fight for quite a while.
I'd argue that Willem Dafoe's casting is the most important thing in that whole film.
Yes, because
if he doesn't get that right, I think... Because I do think that one thing, if there's one element of it that has aged, there are moments of camp and corniness.
Yeah.
To it. I think that might give someone in Gen Z the ick.
Yeah.
So if Defoe's character, who is, he's a serious businessman at the start, but by the end, he's a deranged maniac delivering, like, one-liners that if he's not as good as he is, I think it's sort of tips over the edge into a little bit too goofy.
It's funny you say that because there's that scene right when Harry goes to the hospital to see Peter and Aunt May, and he walks in on MJ and Peter having a moment, and then he goes back to his house and he walks into his house and you just hear Norman Osborn going ah, 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 and the fucking, like, echoing it around the house. My theater erupted in laughter because it is really funny. It's probably supposed to be a little spooky, but it's funny. Like, it's just like
tiny things like that just haven't translated as well. But still, yeah, I think that makes for its own experience. You know,
I do. Yeah,
the first Batman with Keaton, right? That's just locked in time. You know,
and right.
The film, I feel like, is kind of the same way. It's such a incredible representation of the early 2000s, famously, the first teaser for it featured the Twin Towers. Twin Towers was in a bunch of the marketing, and they had to pull that shit out. I know X-Men came out 2 years before this, but I even remember at the time this feeling like the true start of superhero films. So I might go see two next week. The problem is it's a fucking Monday. You know, like, what the fuck.
They have that one extended too. So if you go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you'll probably have a chance. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing how good the swinging still looks. Like, yeah. I think part of that is because they, you know, used cameras to capture it kind of swinging down into the city and stuff. And so the city is real and you're putting a CG character in it, which is really smart. You know, the action
now
of this
they
movie,
do like the reverse of that.
Yes, exactly. It's bizarre because it looks worse now. But the one thing I think is really interesting that I kind of took away on this watch is the action in terms of the punching, the actual core fighting outside of the last scene in the movie. The it's not great, and it's pretty stiff and wooden and rocky. And
it's
but you look
like
at that,
bing, bing, pang, pow.
Yeah,
thing, right?
It is. Yeah. People are like getting hit and moving in like weird way. Like physics does not exist in this movie. And but you look at that, and then you watch the next movie. Mm-hmm. It's like we had a 15-year gap. You know, like
really?
There's a
That's
complete change in the choreography, the
dude,
style, the
like
filmmaking.
Two more. Or
yeah,
one? Yeah.
Two's my favorite movie ever.
Okay, wow, yeah.
I really love that movie. I'm seeing it again next week. That was the first movie I ever saw in a movie theater as well. And I'm really excited to see it again in a movie theater. But yeah, it's night and day difference in terms of filmmaking. And it's so crazy because they started shooting Spider-Man 2 in like 2003. Like, so there was like a year change really, you know, removed. And it's just like I said, feels like there's 10 years of difference there. Feels like it's almost made today, possibly.
All right, well, I'm glad to hear that the experience was everything you hoped it would be. Transitioning a bit to the theater experience, Alex Garland's Civil War was the first movie theater ticket I paid for since seeing Oppenheimer for a second time, because I usually see stuff for work, but because I was away, I missed it. But I like Garland's work enough that I went out to see it. And seeing this movie after I like processed it made me actually realize that I have a flaw in the way that I analyze film, because I don't think I put enough weight in the technical part of it, because I'm more into story. That is sort of, you know, there's action, there's filmmaking, there's story. Of all those things, like, story is kind of my thing. And that is largely what I base my feelings off of about a film. So walking out of this one, I'm like, fuck, man, Garland, I'm frustrated as hell, because while he has long been an incredible, like, image maker, you think of Annihilation, just like everything from The World to The Bears to this film, which has some genuinely like jaw-dropping, your breath leaves your chest images. But his story in this particularly lacked. So that, at first I was like, 2.5 out of 5 stars. But then I thought a bit deeper on like a visceral experience, and in terms of actual professionalism that is required to pull off what he did, and I found myself enjoying it more. But nevertheless, just more on the story thing, like, this is a guy who, when he first started, he was a writer. He was for his sort of twisty films. So the fact that he's becoming a better director should mean that these are the best films of his career. But for some reason, I feel like the complexity of his stories have been sacrificed at the cost of him getting better at other aspects. So I guess that depends on what kind of film and filmmaker you want. I was hyped for Men. I thought the trailer looked sick. Men was a fucking, as far as I'm concerned, disaster. this was not. This was intense in both like a gripping your seat, loud sense, but also intense of like a drama sense in terms of where the characters find themselves, but also intense in a self-reflective sense, being like, oh shit, dude, like, you know, we're like 6 months from this, really, in the worst possible timeline. So all in all, and I think that this is ultimately what Garland is going for, albeit not the reasons that I am, I'm conflicted as hell about how I feel about this film. Politics aside, I think it was wise for him to sort of leave that out. I will say that if you are like, oh, it's not Trump at the start, it is. And And I'd say beyond like the third term thing and like the haircut thing, I'd say that the most telltale sign is that he's like, and we learn later that his side is losing the war, but him being like, this is the, some are saying that this is the greatest army. And these are the first words of the film. Some are saying that this is the greatest army feat of all time. And I'm like, all right, like I see, you know, the vague shadowings of what you're trying to imply here. It's interesting. I've seen reports that it's just as popular in quote unquote red states as it is in blue states. And I think that Garland probably tried to make this film like a Rorschach test wherein either side could see what they want to see
and yeah.
themselves on either side. So in its thematic and production sense, fantastic. In its story and emotional and character sense, it's just not there for me.
It's funny you say that about the red blue state thing, because I went to see this movie with my very right wing father. And he liked it. So
I'm going to bet, like, do you think that you both thought each side was the same side before they reveal at the end, like, who's losing? Because there's that scene in the like the Christmas kind of display thing where that yes. sniper battle is going on, and those two soldiers, I don't think you're supposed to know which side they're on. And the same thing can be said about the Plemons character. So I'm so fascinated if you guys were like rooting for the same side and not realizing it and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do think what you just said about those two snipers, that's like probably the most clear message in the movie, is that if there was a civil war in modern day, it's not going to be like it was, you know, way back when.
Like red shirts and blue shirts.
Yeah, it's not going to be clear. It's going to eventually, because like there's like five factions in this movie, and you can probably imagine there are sub factions within those factions. There are people who just have that, you know, you think about it like this. I don't want to get super duper political, but like there are different levels of Republicans right now. There are like the super duper wacko conspiracy people. There are just the people that are just like, I like Trump because he is better for the economy or whatever. And then there's people who are like abortion and all that stuff. Like there are people who have their different reasons for whatever, and they kind of bow out at certain levels too. They're like, I won't go that far. And you can imagine if there's a civil war, the same thing would happen, right? There are people who would be like, oh, I'm for it because, you know, we need balance or whatever, all these different things. And eventually you just lose it. It's just battle. It's just war that has no meaning. And you have these like two snipers being like, I don't know who I'm fighting. I'm just trying to stay alive. Like that's all it is at that point. And yeah, so while watching the movie, I was a little frustrated, like during big battle scenes, like especially that kind of that first one that's at like some sort of facility. I don't really remember what that place was, if it was like a college or what, but they're pinned down by these soldiers. I was like, I don't know who either of these teams are, and I don't know,
is it the one where Wagner is like holding the girl by like the
yeah and then they bring him out and shoot them all at the end. They capture the prisoners and they shoot them at the end. I was really interested by that. And I do think that's probably the most clear message in the movie, like I said. And whether you think it's well fleshed out or not, I don't know. That's up to you. But I think a lot of this movie is about starting an idea and letting the audience kind of take whatever they want from it and building upon it that way, which is interesting. Again, we can all argue all day about if that's good or bad filmmaking. I don't need this movie to reaffirm my politics or anything like that. And I don't think you're saying that either at all, but I think the Jesse Plemons character is also a very interesting one. Cause like my read on that character, and we know nothing about this guy, by the way, we don't know anything about him besides what he says out loud to us in the scene. We don't know anything about 5 minutes prior. We don't know who those people are that he killed.
I but think to it's me, implied that they're just passer-throughs, like the same type of, you know, the same type of feel.
And that's what I was going to say. Like, I took a lot away from that, though, still, without being told, oh, he comes from this state and he's with this party and whatever.
I don't even necessarily think that that's a political character. I mean, I'm sure he has
views,
but I think that that's more highlighting that there are probably psychos on the fringes. Yes. Who would
that's what I was gonna say.
Who would use the fall of society to run loose.
Because I put a tweet like this, but I was like, he reads to me by the way he's dressed. He's got those weird, like, cheap red glasses. You know, mm-hmm. those aren't uniform, right? And his like shirt isn't tucked in. You know, he reads to me like someone playing, like he's playing the role of authority. He's playing army man because he maybe sees the opportunity to kind of exercise whatever fantasies he wants, however evil they may be. And he's filling a mass grave full of just seemingly civilians and executing people because they're not American. Like, he two people he kills that we know are people who say they're from, like, China or whatever. And that says something. I don't know. But it's just really interesting how, again, that's a character that probably devolved from some larger thing. The Civil War maybe started as something very clear cut, because like they say, the reason the Civil War started is because of the third term. That's the whole thing, is people were not cool with that, and then Civil War broke out.
And that's Garland's whole reasoning for putting California and Texas on the same side, being like, you know, regardless of how different they are, they're very similar in the sense that they are, those are two states that have a uniqueness and a largeness to them that makes them sort of outliers. And they would be willing to put aside what they believe because they both believe, fuck this guy. You know, you can't do this shit. Yeah. But the problem is, I think that that's flawed logic, because we're now at the point where, you know, I don't think, because they show that, like, sort of the Midwest or the quote unquote loyalist states, the Midwest and the Northeast, we're at a point where geography would not define any sort of civil war at all. Because I think we're at a point that whichever party were to get somebody in power for longer than they are supposed to be, I don't have faith that that party, that there would be enough people to be like, whoa, 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 this is not right. I think we're long past that point.
Yeah. And I think,
which is depressing as hell, but you know, that's just how I feel.
Yo, the interesting thing about this is, like, this, I think Garland started writing this movie in like 2019, 2020, something like that. So much has happened since then that, like, if he started with those ideas, they may have played better back then. But January 6th has happened since then, you know? Like, it's one of those things that, like, to tie this into my gaming knowledge, when Red Dead Redemption 2 came out, the head of Rockstar was asked, hey, like, would you do Grand Theft Auto 6? Like, are you guys going to do that? And he said, I'm glad we're not doing it right now because our world moves so fast. Because Grand Theft Auto is a satirical series that parodies America and all these things, and he says the world is moving so fast that by the time we released it would be like outdated, and it's just funny to think about that, you know, with this movie having taken 5 years to make, how much has changed. We've had a pandemic, we've had the BLM protests and all that stuff, and the January 6th thing, and, you know, so much has happened that whatever ideas Garland might have started with may have played better back when he started, but may be a little more illogical now. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Civil War, despite the fact that I do ultimately like it, I like Garland's other works so much more that it ultimately winds up pretty low on my rankings. Now, we both haven't seen everything he's done. I haven't seen his movies Let Me Go, which he wrote, Dread, which he wrote and apparently directed behind the scenes, more or less, and his FX show Dev. So, Cade, what have you not seen?
Sunshine. I've seen Parks of Dread.
What?
I know. It's one of those blind spots for me. Oh, I know. We can talk all day about my blind spots. Yeah. And Men.
Okay. So I am going to read mine in reverse order from bottom to top, and then you do the same. So I've got Men at the bottom. Men is, it starts off promising and creepy, but then it just devolves into an absolute mess. I've got Civil War next. Again, this is just how good I think this guy is. Annihilation, 28 Days Later, Ex Machina, and then number one, Sunshine.
Yeah, I know people really love that. I can't blame you. Okay. I'm going to go... and this is a great movie, so don't make it sound like I'm hating, but Annihilation, probably at the bottom. Civil War, then Ex Machina, and then 28 Days Later. I think that's the list.
And he's involved in 28 Years Later as well, so that should be... Yeah, that should be sick. Okay, let's talk about Fallout. I binge watched this, which I don't really do that often. It helps that I was sick as hell. I had the fucking stomach flu, and it was just an absolute nightmare. So I just spent the whole weekend crushing TV. So I caught up on X-Men 97 and this. We will talk about X-Men 97 hopefully in the next few weeks if I can get Brandon on the line. Long story short, it's sick. And watching it, you're like, all right, Marvel is probably going to, you know, their next 10, 15 years is going to be around this team, because you realize that I think that they're ultimately their golden goose. I think that they allow for more depth just by their inherent creation and what they are than more depth, and the team dynamic is genuine and not forced than anything else they do. So we will talk about that in a few weeks, but Fallout. So Cade, you're the game guy. I'm going to let you largely take the reins here. I did see you tweet today about Todd Howard confirming the canon and the timeline and all that stuff. So why don't you tell us first what that is and why that's important?
Well, so there's this game, Fallout New Vegas, right? Came between Fallout 3 and Fallout 4. And that was not made, developed by Bethesda, because they were making Skyrim. So Fallout 3 was a hit, and they're like, we should probably, you know, capitalize on this. So they're like, let's go to this other team that is known for making RPGs and has some DNA with the original Fallout games. And they said, go make Fallout New Vegas with Fallout kind of 3's like mechanics and stuff. And it's probably the most beloved Fallout game, and people think that maybe there's some bad blood with Bethesda and Obsidian because the quote-unquote best game in the series, which is totally subjective, wasn't made by them, and maybe they kind of are frustrated by that. There's all these rumblings about that. Who knows how true that actually is? I think it's probably a little bit overblown, but at the end of Fallout, we see...
spoiler warning.
New Vegas has been destroyed, and or is at least in total disrepair compared to where it was in the game. And
okay, see, I did not know that. I thought that is how it was. As is. Okay.
Because it was like this kind of shining mecca.
Because I had read that it was built intentionally because it would be like out of the way of
It's this whole thing, but like when you go to New Vegas in the game, it's like, wait, there's like huge power, like there's all these tall buildings, like there's a working casino, there's all these casinos actually. It's like this walled off city that is like, oh, I can go here and like live a life. This is what it was like, and live a life of luxury. And within that, there's also this other place that was bombed, which is a big central point of the series, is
Shady Sands.
People are like, okay, this like retcons all these games and stuff, and like this didn't actually happen. This means they're trying to act like New Vegas didn't happen, or they hate it so much that they destroyed it. And it's like very much not that, because I'm like, in my opinion, just from a fan's point of view, I'm like, they would just act like they wouldn't address it, right? New Vegas just wouldn't be in the fucking show if they didn't want it to be in the show. You know, right. They don't have to go there. But yeah, so they came out today and they said everything that happened in the games happened in the show. Like, this is all running in tandem. The show is the kind of last canonical entry. So we are up to date now in the show's timeline. It is the like Rise of Skywalker, so to speak, in terms of if we're looking at a timeline.
But aren't they doing 5?
They will be doing 5, and that will presumably be set after. I shouldn't make it sound like it's the end of the series. I'm just saying, like, we are up to date. There will be Fallout 5, presumably set in the timeline after this. Gotcha. So, yeah, people have been all up in a fuss about that. It's really dumb. I don't really get how people... Fallout fans can be really fucking stupid and annoying. There's just so much. And this is the thing that happens with a game that lets you choose your own ending, too. It's like, yeah, of course some things aren't going to be canon. Like, that's just how it is. Like,
right.
We are making our own adventure, and then eventually when you make something like this, you kind of have to canonize it, or otherwise it's going to be its own offshoot universe, and I don't think that is good. Because this series makes a lot of really cool choices to further the mythos of Fallout, such as Vault-Tec's hand in the nukes and the Great War.
So that's not something from the games.
It's
implied but not stated.
Yeah, it may have been like something that's like loosely theorized and stuff, but like this is the first time it's like, no, Vault-Tec is like
evil,
basically. Yeah, like we knew they're kind of up to some shady shit, but it's like, why were all these experiments happening in the vaults and stuff? And it's like, we now know why. They're trying to create kind of like the next step in human evolution. They're trying to restart humanity manually.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
But yeah, I think this is the best video game adaptation to date because it continues the canon of the universe. It makes it feel fresh.
But a lot of people have been saying that. Is that a groupthink going on here, or you know, you really believe that?
Yeah, I think this is the best video game adaptation to date, simply because it's for everybody. Like, it'll be new for everybody, right? Like, for The Last of Us, I played those games, so I knew where everything was going. I was still engaged by it, and I still really liked it. But I didn't have the same sense of awe as I do here, where everything feels new. And I'm also still able to be like, that's from that game, or I recognize that, and you know, be like, oh, this is what this means for that thing I played when I was fucking 10 years old. You know, that's cool. To have something that I can also show to someone and be like, hey, I know you don't know what these games are, but this is just good TV and you don't need to know anything. It'll catch you up. It'll tell you what you need to know. And then, you know, what we're seeing right now is a ton of these Fallout games are getting a massive surge of players right now. And so people, both fans and newcomers, are going and checking out these games. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. And I think having someone like Jonathan Nolan helping helm this series, someone who's responsible for Interstellar, the Dark Knight trilogy, Westworld, all these great things, come in here, lend his expertise to such a beloved video game franchise, and working in tandem with the video game creators like Todd Howard, is just great. It's everything a video game project should be, and that makes my heart happy.
You touched on, like, you'll see things like, oh, that's from that game. What are some of, like, off the top of your head, like, some of the best sort of winks and nods that you recall from the show?
The Rangers from New Vegas. They're these guys with the, I don't know how to describe them besides, they're like these guys in these like dusters and helmets with these red eyes. You see him, I think, in episode 7 at the beginning. They're like looking through the sand, and then he waves at another one. Those are the Rangers from the NCR. The NCR is a big thing. Seeing them make a return is really cool, and having them be such a big piece of this. The Fallout 4 theme music plays at one point, which was really cool because I think that music's really good. It's when she is wandering through Vault 4 and she sees the NCR
says,
flag.
It said in the subtitles for Fallout 4 playing, and I was like, oh.
Yeah. And that's just good music, so that made me happy. There's probably other things, but it's just Oh, Mr. House, who is like the antagonist of Fallout New Vegas, shows up. He is a computer man in the game, but he is alive. He's one of the people on the like council at Vault Tech in the last episode.
Yeah, I saw that one.
So stuff like that's just like,
oh, right? And he was smoking a cig.
Yeah, kind of like the Howard Stark looking guy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so stuff like that's just like, that's great. Those are things I never expected to A, see again, B, in this TV show, and have them play such a critical role too. It's not like, that's not just for me to point at the screen. No, I know that. That's like, this recontextualizes a lot of stuff of being like, oh my God, this guy is responsible for the end of the world. You know, like that's huge stuff.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
That's a big no-no.
Exactly. So it's just like, that's fucking sweet.
I mean, in terms of it being a video game adaptation, I think the way that it's most successful, more so than any show has been before, is that it embraces what it's actually like being a player in this world.
Yeah.
Like the Lucy character, like I saw that they released the official stats for her in the pool. But like, even if they didn't do that, you get that vibe of like the way in which both her outfit and her personality and her intelligence and her battle skills like level up throughout the way. Walton Goggins has this one great line. He's like, the wasteland has one golden rule. Thou shalt get sidetracked by bullshit every goddamn time or something. Like that is such an embrace of what the gaming world, what these Fallout games and what these type of games in general are all about.
Yeah.
So I loved the way in which it wasn't like, let's take the ideas of this game and turn it into a show. It was, let's turn this game into
a show. It feels like a new Fallout game, which is like the biggest compliment I can give it. It's like, I'm getting a new Fallout experience, which is great because the last one came out in 2015 and we probably won't get another one until the 2030s. Unless some other studio starts doing it because they're making The Elder Scrolls 6 right now. And to build off what you were saying as well, it's like they utilize the mechanics of the game in the show, like using a stim pack, which in the games is like your first aid kit, heals bones and like just mortal wounds.
Right.
And they just do it in the show. They're like, yeah, fuck it. Why not? And there's a whole bit about being over encumbered. If you're carrying too many items in the game, you can't run.
Right.
And there's a guy that runs around with a big gigantic backpack in the show. And there was another one. Oh, you see Lucy's little brother doing the hacking minigame on the Overseer's terminal. And I'm like, that's literally the exact thing you would see in the video game. And it's just like, I love that. That's so fun and they're not trying to shy away from the fact that, yes, this is a video game. Like, we're not ashamed, and so many adaptations, I think, are. And it embraces it and utilizes it in a new media, which is really cool.
Yeah, I've been seeing it compared a lot to the Halo show and how the creators of that were like, we didn't even play the games, which I can't believe people like this are being allowed to helm multi-million dollar shows. Like, what the fuck, man.
Even if
I somewhat understand the point he's trying to make, like we're trying to not let the games box us in and create a new thing and have new ideas and not be sort of have pre-informed ideas of what we're going to do and let that sway us, but at the same time it's like, do you understand what the word adaptation means?
Yeah, it's also like, well, do you understand why people like it? Like, so if you're going to do something completely different, of course you're going to have people being like, this isn't what I love. And you're
but then on the flip it. Side of that, but then on the flip side of that, Jonathan Nolan has apparently been a fan of the series since like he played 3, which came out 20 years ago or something. So
2008.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you go. One thing I do want to touch on is like, I talked about how I'm big on story. And I think that that's where this show succeeded the most.
Yeah.
The Brotherhood of Steel character, Maximus, is written so stupidly to an extent that I have to think it's on purpose. But other than that, the way in which the main three characters interweave, as I touched on, the way in which Lucy grows as like a literal player and survivor in this world, the way that they're fleshing out the ghoul's arc with flashbacks and having him present day, like as soon as as soon as he showed up, I mean, I guess you get that vibe, but as soon as he showed up in the finale where he's like, you know, the old ones had this flaw, I'm like, oh, so they're going to babyface turn him here. Not quite babyface turn him, but compared to where we meet him, where he just murders everyone he sees, to now, like, palling around with this girl who he has a respect for while also sort of saving the day and, like, being on this, like, vigilante mission to literally get vengeance on the people who ended the world. Yeah. That, to me, is compelling as hell. Goggins is one of the best in the game right now, just in terms of somebody who holds the screen, whether he's playing good or bad. So the opportunity for him to get to both is sick. He's hamming it up in a great way. Some of his, like, Old West gunslinger lines are written and delivered so well.
I do this shit for the love of the game.
He's I wonder if it's like an Emmy worth kind of thing, because he's also playing like a family man in the flashbacks, and now he's doing a whole spy thing. But I also love the arcs that they set up for season two, right? So Lucy's whole like growing XP thing, the ghouls moral arc, the little brother getting trapped in the vault, like that fucking like, I don't know how the hell he's going to get out of there. The whole vault tech conspiracy theory that they've got going on in the past timeline, I love, because I love a good old, like, nefarious I don't love them. I love them used in stories, like nefarious powers pulling the string, but one man is, like, getting to the bottom of it. Like, I love shit like that. And then, of course, New Vegas, which just on its face, I could, if I knew nothing about the games itself and I was told Fallout 1 and 2 take place in Cali, right?
God, I don't know. That,
Fallout 3 is DC and Fallout 4 is Boston.
Yeah.
All right, if you told me all the locales, I'd be like, well, New Vegas sounds the coolest by a mile. So it on its face value is an extremely exciting prospect, forgetting the potential stories that it comes with. So I love the way that this ended. I love the way it told the story, and I'm psyched for it to get more. I did tweet a bit about sort of, for whatever reason, maybe the success of the show, both in terms of how it's been received and how much it's been viewed. But people have been like, oh, the binge model. Where did this come from? Not like, where did this come from? But people are acting like this is the first time this has ever happened. Like,
holy shit. Revolutionary. Yeah.
The conversation feels louder than ever before. Like, I don't get why they do this. To me, it's really a no-brainer. The way that these companies make money, and there's something very vault tech about them all. How their goal is ideally, it's not it their ultimate goal can never be achieved, because their ultimate goal is new signups. They always need new people in perpetuity forever.
It'll never happen.
So the way that they do that, or the way that they think that they do that is, and this is why they all suck up IP, right? Because it's, all right, I already have this established fan base here, so let's fold them into our tent, okay?
Yeah.
So they do that for big popular stuff, Marvel, Fallout, and so on and so forth. And I hope, all right, we're just going to fucking inject them full of this shit, give them as much of it as possible, hope they like it, and then hope they stay on the app. I understand the streaming, the binge model. I don't think it's good, but I understand it. The problem that it creates is that what they get in return for sort of upfront viewership and growing numbers, they lose in extended conversation and engagement, but also increase in patience for the next season, because instead of watching it in 2 months, you watch it in 2 days. So I finished Fallout already and I miss it. I'm going to have to wait another 2 years for
couple
it.
Years.
Now,
yeah.
Granted, had it gone on over the course of 8 weeks, I would still have to wait 2 years, but the experience would have felt longer. And then therefore it wouldn't feel like some, you know, if you go on a trip to a beach for 3 days, you're like, fuck, that was too short. If you go on a trip to a beach for 2 months, you're like, I'm kind of glad to be home. So that is the issue that the streaming model creates. Ideally, they knew this was going to be a hit. Probably. I spoke to Lisa Joy in 2021 and they were working on it then. So they're probably pretty far down the line on season two, short of like actually fucking shooting it. Now that it's a success, you can bet your ass that Prime is going to be like, all right, let's go. Let's get back in the 100%. Shop. So, yeah, those are my thoughts on Fallout. Great, exciting, fun. You know, this is sort of a general modern film making TV complaint. The way that it's color washed and so bright is kind of insane. I saw someone or like when the first clip come out, they edited over like a prescription drug kind of like logo and theme song, and the way that the setting was lit is like, oh, that's, this looks like a fucking commercial. But you know, that when everything else is working so well, I'm not going to ride their ass for not perfectly rendering
a
Fallout world.
You'll never get
do
there,
that
honestly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's swing over to a pair of interviews that I've got. First up is Scoop McNairy. He's been in Argo. He's been Killing Them Softly, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, Narcos, Hall and Catch Fire, so on and so forth. Scoop was awesome. He's one of the best character actors in the game today, as far as I'm concerned. I told him he's one of those oh hell yeah guys. And then I've got Garrett Hedlund. You know him as the star of Tron Legacy. He was also in Triple Frontier with that A-list cast, Four Brothers, Friday Night Lights, and so on and so forth. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Folks, today I am joined by Scoop McNairy, one of my favorite actors who you know from projects such as Argo, Gone Girl, Narcos, and Halt and Catch Fire, and his new film Blood for Dust, which releases in theaters and digital on April 19th. Thank you for your time today, man.
Hey, Eric, thank you so much for having me, man.
So I actually want to start with something you've got coming up next. I actually live up the block from the bar of where A Complete Unknown is being filmed. Are you on set these days?
I'm back in California now, but no, I just got back from there like about a week ago.
You're the only character on the call sheet who doesn't have a name yet. What's going on there?
When they released it, they said I was involved in the film. They didn't release the character. On a project like this, there's certain secrecy. I just assumed that they didn't want anybody to know. So I feel like I probably shouldn't say anything.
You aren't playing Mick Jagger, right?
That would be, I'm not going to deny or like, but that would be awesome if I was playing Mick Jagger.
Have you heard him do The Voice yet, Timmy?
Have I heard what?
Have you heard him do his voice yet? The Dylan voice.
Oh, yeah, no. The only thing I can say about Timmy is he is so phenomenal in this movie. And I just feel like he's so good. Not to mention like such a great person to be around, incredibly nice. Lovely to work with, but I can't wait. I only saw some bits and pieces of what he's doing with Bob.
Yeah, where they shot at that bar last week in that park, that's where I live. I'm like right there. All right, but let's start with your new film, Blood for Dust. I don't think I'm really breaking any ground here, which I think it reminded me a lot of one of your previous films, and that's Killing Them Softly. Did that occur to you at all?
No, not really.
Here's why. I think it looks at how men react to the pressures of earning a living and surviving in the American system.
Okay. I see the correlations in yes, there's some correlations to the film's through line. I was sort of looking at it as characters. Yes. In Blood for Dust, it's an everyday man who's fallen upon desperate measures based on his, you know, situation. That has to do whatever he's got to do to take care of his family. Frankie and Killing Them Softly, I just felt like it was a jackass that was just constantly making mistakes based on his own admissions, you know, just wasn't the smartest kid in the tool shed. That being said, I feel like Frankie was, this world was sort of normal to him, but with Cliff, I feel like he's has lived a sort of mundane, quiet life that, you know, he's definitely a fish out of water in this world and doesn't feel like he really knows what's going to come next. And I feel that lended himself to really be in shock a lot of the time of trying to keep his composure together, but also being like in shock from this world that he's so far removed from. That being said, I feel like the when we started Blood for Dust, it was during the pandemic, and you know, economically it was harder times, and I still feel like we're in that same sort of time right now. So I feel like the film is very poignant for it to be, you know, coming out right now, that people can identify with in that character.
It also reminds me of and I didn't even write this down, it just occurred to me now. Have you seen The Drop with Tom Hardy and Gandolfini?
The Drop, is that the one with the dog?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah,
but, I did. But it's like this quiet, unassuming guy who, although that character is more in the criminal world, it's sort of the same thing about this quiet, unassuming guy who you never really see coming. And then at the end, he's the one who still has his head above ground, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. Not to totally sidetrack, I was watching this interview the other day with Sammy the Bull, you know, and you could be the craziest gangster in the world and just be born with empathy, you know, or not, you know. And so, sorry to sidetrack there, but, you know, there's something that's, I don't know, there's something that's empathetic in Frankie, you know, but in with Cliff, I don't know. I just feel like,
well, I think he's so one track minded that he doesn't have time for empathy. Yeah. He's got one goal here.
Yeah. He does not really, he's just thinking of how do I get out of this situation and get the money and get unscathed. I think the further and further along that he gets into it, there's a certain side of Cliff that starts to enjoy this a little bit, because it's so much more exciting than his normal life, you know, and dangerous, that there's a certain side that I felt as a character sort of leaning into it the further we got into that story of being deer in headlights, in shock but mesmerized.
Is there a particular draw for you? I feel like your characters are consistently unassuming men who find themselves in overwhelming circumstances and have to keep it together. Is that something that you find yourself seeking out? Like, I think of Argo, or even to a lesser extent, Killing Him Softly. Like you said, he's not quiet, but he's a moron. And now he's in way too deep. You're a guy here, you know, he's in a life he's never really known. I guess what I'm trying to get at is there a certain type of hero that you like to play? Hero in quotes, meaning they're the lead of the story.
You know, I think that every character is sort of trying to overcome something or has been called to some journey, and what's that journey he will, you know, change or transpire into to something else. I lost my train of thought.
What type of leads you like to play?
Yeah, I feel like they all come with some sort of thing that they need to overcome, you know, or some journey that they get called on. I feel like that's a pretty continuous through line. I mean, it's not always often that I play leads. So, right. So it's the same situation, but on a much smaller scale and playing other parts, but you're really there to support the leading actors, whatever journey or hurdles that they're sort of overcoming. So I don't know. I don't know. I think that maybe it's just me. So I don't know, but maybe it's just me of just finding that thing that this character is in each of these projects or all these projects that they're struggling with, that they're trying to overcome. Cause you want to, in films, you really want to see somebody succeed. You know what I mean? You want to root for them, and in order to root for them, or I feel like to identify them with the person watching the movie, they feel like they have to overcome something, and that makes it identifiable, which makes you keep watching. And that's, I don't know that, I'm just, that's my interpretation.
This is not to me to say that I think you always play the same character. Today, I just watched Monsters. And the type of lead you're playing in that is much different than the one in this one. But I still find them to be in similar circumstances relative to who they are. You touched on something that I was going to ask you about being the lead. Does that change the mentality you have going into a film, or are you simply just trying to put forth your best work at all times?
That's a really great question, Eric. No, I think that when you're playing a lead, I think there is a certain consciousness that one needs to have about where the character is going when the character makes a transition around the second or third act, you know, and how that they're changed. I think that's something that's really important to kind of figure out in your performance as to where you want to arc that or you know, and sometimes it's a conversation with the powers that be of why you don't want to do something here because you want to show it off here or, you know, or build or so. Yeah, I mean, as a storyteller, as well as an actor, as a storyteller, those are definitely conscious things that are you're constantly thinking about of, you know, how can you tell this story and drag your audience with you? You know, it's really important that they come with you and not just watch you. I don't probably always nail it, but, you know, that's what I'm definitely always striving for.
What was it like staring down the bottom of Kit's stash? Because that was something.
Kit was awesome. Man, he was just great. I loved.
Was that thing real or was that glue on? That was real.
No. He came film ready, you know. He was great. Like the first day of work, just seeing what he had put together for this character.
Really good turn from him. Did not see that coming.
I didn't see it coming either. And so after that first day, it just got me so excited about the film and like adding this other element to it and what he was doing. And not to mention, he's incredibly lovely to be around, wonderful to work with. But yeah, he just did such an incredible job with this. And it was so great to work with him. And I loved that character that
he put together. Did you know the stash was coming, or did it catch you by total surprise?
No, I think that, you know, when you have that much facial hair in a film, I think that Rod probably went through it to make sure that everybody didn't have a...
I don't even know what you call that.
So it's not the goatees club, men's club, you know, all showing
up. It's like an old West gunslinger mustache. Yeah. I want to ask you about Once Upon a Time. What is something that happened to you on a Quentin Tarantino set that never happened to you before?
Just the excitement of Quentin. He's so lovely to work with, but... just watching him on set direct and talk and tell stories. And it was just different than most films you watch. It really feels like when you're making the movie, Quentin Tarantino is the star and you're watching him. And he
put himself on the poster.
Yeah, he's so entertaining and so such a cinephile that, you know, he just knows so much about movies. And so it's educational, but it's also entertaining. Not to say that other directors aren't entertaining, but they are in their different ways. But working with him was so much fun to just watch him, even when, you know, he doesn't know he's being watched. He's just a really entertaining individual.
You know, that's a film that I walked into expecting it to be like Pulp, right? And I just remember this unique feeling of walking out kind of bummed at the time, but in the years since, it's grown on me and grown on me and grown on me. And now I have it in my top three of his films. And I watched probably 2-3 times a year. So I threw on your scene today. And it is like basically the ultimate Tarantino scene. It's a meta Western with Leo and Timothy Oliphant. Do you have like an out-of-body experience in that kind of moment? Like what's going through your head? Because you are a strong, well-known, working actor. But right there, that's like the zenith of your craft, right? So what's going through your mind in those moments?
Don't screw up, you know. Don't you know, just try and be comfortable. I mean, Timothy Oliphant was so amazing, man. They didn't give you the script for this movie, and I didn't get it. So he kind of saw that I was like, what's going on? I know I got this scene, you know. And he came over to me, that's the first thing out of his mouth. He's like, they didn't give you the script, did they? And I was like, no. He goes, all right, let me sit down and talk. And he sat down for 10 minutes, man, and told me as much information as he could about it to help me out. So he was great. And then obviously working with Leo, man, that guy is the cream of the crop, greatest actor in our business in years, and he's constantly doing new things. So I've been watching him for years, been a fan of him for years. So yeah, no, absolutely. It was really great to be able to come in and do something that was with him or just be in a movie that he's in.
Another iconic director you have worked with is David Fincher on Gone Girl. Basically everybody who's worked with Fincher seems to have a David Fincher story, right? Of him, you know, 10,000 takes or moving some little thing in the background. Do you have one? What pops to mind?
I
you don't have to get yourself in trouble either, to be clear.
Well, I'll say this, like, you know, he does do a lot of takes, which I like, you know, and I enjoy just going and going and going and going. But that said, it's me talking pretty much the whole time to Ben. Well, you know, Ben doesn't say anything, so eventually he fell asleep, you know, and I, you know, he's tired, he's working long days and stuff, so I think it was me just running my mouth and stuff, and so I just looked over one time and saw that Ben was kind of dozing off, you know what I mean, didn't bother me at all, you know, but I look back and think that was such a an interesting moment. You know, David come in and he's just great, man. He's like so specific and so detailed. He was just, and again, was on my list of people I really wanted to work with. So I was just elated to be there.
I'm sorry for going through your greatest hits here, man. But Argo, Best Picture. At what moment does it occur to you, oh shit, I'm on a special film here?
I was sitting in a bar in Maori, Australia, shooting the Rover. And I had a day off. There was nothing out there. And everybody's horse gambling on these TV screens. There's only about five people in the bar. And all of a sudden, the Academy Awards come up, you know? And I saw it in a tiny bar with four minors.
But I'm saying more so to yourself. When did you realize, like, oh, fuck, this film's going to be really good? Like, at what point does it occur to you that you're not only working on a good movie, you're maybe working on a Best Picture type film?
I don't know. I don't. You never know, man. Like you can.
You really don't know. You really don't know until it's gone and cut. Wow. Okay.
You can take the one that you think is gonna be the thing, and then this thing over here. You just don't know. So I think you just sort of pick them based on like what movies I like. Like what movies I would go see that movie. So I want to be a part of making that movie. Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, you know, I grew up, you know, right when they were winning their Academy Award. I was probably 16 years old. So I was watching those guys for years and just had so much admiration for them. So to be on one of Ben's movies he's directing, again, man, you know, I was just so stoked to be there and so stoked to be working with Ben and this movie. And it wasn't till that it, you know, started getting critically acclaimed and then the awards, that, you know, I don't know. I think the industry or the middle America or the world tells you if they like your movie, you don't really get to tell them.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is a good movie. Y'all just don't know. I mean, you know what I mean? So it was received well, and I was just really happy to be in it.
I asked you about A Complete Unknown. You also have a film called Night Bitch coming out. There was this very funny graphic that came out of CinemaCon of like, Disney's films next year, and it was like, you know, Marvel, whatever, and then there's boom, Night Bitch. So tell me, you know, how'd that go? How's that looking? Are you psyched for it? How's Amy Adams in what I'm sure is a fucking gonzo performance?
Gonzo. I mean, she's phenomenal. I mean, she's great in everything, so it's hard to say that this is the best thing she's ever done, but it's definitely up there. She was lovely to work with, lovely to be around. Mari Heller, who wrote the adaptation from the book, I just think has made a very unique film, and I don't think people really know what they're going to see when they go see this film. I was able to see it, I don't know, about a month ago or something, and just loved it. I just loved it. I couldn't feel like it was more accurate and more sort of grounded in this ungrounded way. I don't want to say too much about it because I just don't think people know what this movie is going to be, and I think it's better to go in with knowing nothing about it.
Totally, totally fine. I mean, the name and plot alone is enough to put an ass in a seat. Scoot, as I said at the top, you're one of my favorite performers. There's been this meme going around on Twitter where it'll just be like very famous supporting actors, and the caption will be, dudes will see this and just say, hell yeah. You are absolutely one of those guys.
No way. That's amazing.
You are one of those guys, man. You pop up on screen and dudes are just saying, hell yeah, all over the place.
Oh, man. Well, Eric, I can't thank you enough for all the kind things you said, and also for taking the time to speak with me for this interview, man. It's been really enjoyable talking to you.
Thanks, man. Scoot, cheers. Today, I am joined by Garrett Hedlund, who you know from projects such as Four Brothers, Tron Legacy, Triple Frontier, and his new film, Absence of Eden, which hits theaters on April 12th. Thank you for your time today, man.
Thank you, brother.
Thanks. First of all, congrats on the film. This was interesting, man. It was gripping plot, intense acting, gorgeously shot. I thought it was like a Sicario with a twisted love story, which is pretty high praise as far as I'm concerned.
Why, thank you. Yeah, that's Marco. He's, you know, he's an artist. He's a poet. And you know, I feel like every single frame in this film, he had such a glorious there was an intention and meaning and books worth of meaning behind every frame, and that's what's beautiful about Marco.
Well, you could tell, and that leads me to what I want to ask. This is his first feature, and I'm curious, as a star yourself, how you sort of weigh up the risk of starring in somebody whose work you have not seen before. And how you come to the choice to star in said film?
Well, I've known Marco for quite some time. Him and Zoe have been dear friends for a very long time. There's a trust, you know. And look, even if it wasn't Marco, first time film directors, everybody's got to have a start. Everybody's got to have a place to be able to showcase all their hunger, determination, drive. That hunger is absolutely infectious. It's revitalizing to come across somebody that is so creatively and artistically driven that all they want to do is express. Like, man, when you come across that, it's hold on to it. And that's the epitome of what Marco is. It's essential, you know, for us for me to be around somebody so just passionately and poetically driven, not only with film, with painting, with sculpture, but with life.
Hmm. So I always like to ask this when the star rocks notable facial hair, the stash, do you have any input on that? Like, how do you come down to doing that style of stash?
Well, I'm very happy you asked this question. You know, when that's all that's, first, there's a handbook on this. There's a rule book. There's a rule book of the cans and cannot do of facial hair when you're in, you know, when you're in, when you work for the law and certain forms. And so, look, you know, Marco won the stash. He got the stash.
All right. That's the
that
one.
I'll say though, I was glad I did too, because
it's rocked the hell out of it, man.
Look,
you rocked it.
It's beautiful when I don't know if I'd done one thing that had a stash prior to that. Mudbound, I had a stash. It was a glued-on stash. Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but that one was in the Absence of Eden. This genuinely was a beautiful moment when I was sitting in the trailer. I think I took a picture. And I wondered what was so ironic about the photo. And I looked at it and I said, man, this is one of the first times that I so powerfully and genuinely saw my father in it. My father, he was a big mustache man. Always had the mustache, at least when he was younger, kind of maybe around, you know, specifically the age I was when we shot this. So for me, it was, I felt like I was looking at my father with that stash.
And how does that make you feel? Do you feel scared of that fact? Like, fuck, I'm my old man now. Or is there a sense of pride? Like, how does that feel to you?
No, pride, connection, you know, made me smile.
Yeah.
Wonderfully. Yeah. Brought back memories I'd missed. And yeah. So look, I know you got a little something growing down here, but if having a stash could do that for me, God only knows what it could do for you.
I've been telling my dad to grow out his beard. He's not having it. All right, let's get down to something real. What separates this role from sort of the stereotype Southern lawman that you're used to seeing in film, and why did that appeal to you?
Well, it's he's a particular guy. It's this one, the character, you know, as written, was you know, a man trying to find his footing, find his ground in life. He hadn't been dealt the best of cards. He had a complex and distorted sort of past and distorted definition of family. So he's trying to find a path in the woods. In landing this job, he's now sort of confronted with fears he never really realized he was going to be confronted with. But then he's dealing with this sort of tug of war between land, being a man, love, and the law, and having to really get introspective and really use his sort of moral compass to make sense of all of this. And that's something I wanted to play with, especially with Marco, especially with Zoe.
You've played tons of heroes before, but what were the challenges of playing one that's insanely realistic, but also one that inhabits a controversial job?
I never really saw him as a hero at all.
Interesting.
I saw him as somebody that perhaps, you know, his job was asking him to put on a cape and he was potentially being confronted with the questions of if he has to go through all this, does he really want to fly? But is this even flight? You know, what are the powers that he's been granted in the first place? And really makes him ask these questions. I mean, I don't know.
You're asked to do some intense performance in this, some of which is physical, some of which is very emotional, both anger and sadness. Are you all tapping into the same space when you're trying to G yourself up for those type of scenes? Or is it coming from a different part of you? Like, I'm thinking of the scene where, and not to try to spoil too much, where you get into quite a tussle and your partner needs to act quick. And then there's one in the hotel room. Those are both similar level of intensities, but different feelings.
Yeah. And they could be, you know, both the first scenes of the day right off the bat, you know. No, I just, look, I'm one that, when you're dealing with a script like this, a character like this, a subject matter such as this, my first instinct, my first question is how do we make it the most realistic as possible? How do we make it the most honest as possible? The most convincing that the audience is watching, you know, a documentary. How do we do that? then if we do everything this the script asked, or our intuitions or instincts told us to do, or everything we desired, how can we flip the switch and surprise in a way and make something happen nobody saw coming, make something of that, you know, throw a curveball into the mix. I don't know. This, it's just how I work. I'm always trying to make something, you know, more or the most it could be, or take it all the way down to less and less and less. I guess I just want to make somebody, you know, feel, perhaps be moved or perhaps relate. And so, that comes with a great deal of feeling it a lot yourself, and just going there. And luckily on this film, we had wonderful artists that go there as well. With Zoe, I feel both of us work in a very similar manner. That
she's throwing high heat in this one.
That we can, you know, go as ballistic and sadomasochistic as you know, one could, and you know, and take it down to a complete whisper. We like to dance that way. That's why I wanted to work with her on this. That's why I was so great to. That's why I was the, you know, it was so great to be a part of this. You know, when you work with artists, you get to you know, learn ballet every, you know, a new sort of ballet every film.
So I have got a bit of a selfish one here. In Tron, you got to work with one of my all-time favorites in Jeff Bridges. He is one of the living icons in your lineup. Well, is that his voice? Is that his laugh?
No, he's... Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say, what's the first thing that pops into your head from your time with Jeff?
Oh, man. I'd never... came across somebody that felt like so much of a long lost brother to myself. Wow. You know, a companion, a student of life, a co-pilot, passionate about music, film, and what makes, you know, people and things and tunes and everything tick. He's you know, he's a I said this the other day, and I was wondering why it's never been on a t-shirt, but Jeff Bridges is a way of life.
Oh, I love that, dude. I love that. He is, man. That is so great to hear you say that. It seems like he is in real life the way that he comes across.
Yeah, his love for life, family, and art is absolutely infectious and astonishing, and you want to be around it and you want to collaborate with it. It's, you know, and even if we take it back to old Marco, very similar. Zoe, very similar, you know. Yeah.
And then I just got one more for you in that sense. The cast.
Bring it on. We can go all day.
I wish. Tell them in the background. Triple Frontier, A-list stars out the wazoo. I know that you and Charlie are still boys, it seems like. What was the dynamic of that like? Because I have a hard time thinking of such a sort of elite cast of like classic leading men in one film, and I could only imagine what it was like to be part of that.
That was another wonderful situation. Charlie and I, we'd been looking for a film to do together. You know, we'd been friends for we shot then 2018, shit, time's passing. You know, we'd been friends for like 15 years at that point, trying to figure out a film to do together. Oscar and I, that was our third film together, you know, so.
Right, Llewyn Davis, and what's the third one?
Mojave.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, that's like the perks of the job to be in this and get to work with pals and go explore, go see the world, you know, play some fun characters, be on screen, perhaps, you know, share with your family. Oscar just had a child at that point.
Wow.
It's beautiful, beautiful location. Wonderful JC, wonderful director, wonderful team, Netflix, beautiful team.
I rewatched it today. That's a fucking sick movie. Sick movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Garrett, I've got a wrap here. Congrats. This is sick as well. I hope people go out and see it because I really enjoyed it.
Brother man, appreciate you.
Thank you, man. Cheers. Thank you. All right. Thank you to Scoot and Garrett for joining me. I hope you all enjoyed today's show. I hope you have seen all the stuff that we've seen and enjoyed it as much as we have. If you're going to Spider-Man, hit us up on Twitter and let us know how you liked that. I do want to talk X-Men in the coming weeks. I think there's 8 episodes or 10. The 6th one just released today. Nowhere near the high of what 5 was, which was like one of the most gripping pieces of superhero storytelling that I've seen on screen and since Endgame probably. Wow. Yeah, really, really good. Really, 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 because what you have to understand is they're making more seasons of this. So there isn't a finality to it. But in terms of the scope of this story with these characters, they're towards the end of it, not towards the start of it. So there are like plot lines and conclusions that were started 25 years ago ending now.
Yeah.
Which I don't. I've been trying to watch the show, but man, it's not that it's not good, but compared to 97, it just looks so fucking old. So I think I'm going to skip ahead a few seasons, but even though I haven't seen them, the storylines are simple enough that you get the gist, right? So episode 5 was like an epic conclusion to like decades of story. I didn't see it coming at all, not to spoil. And I'm not even gonna say like what happens, but it feels more important, like more consequential and important than anything Marvel has done since Endgame. It's one of those like walk out of the theaters dazed type of thing. Like, what the fuck just happened to me? So we'll talk that in a couple weeks. I know there's a few more movies coming out. Challengers is coming out. Oh, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming out.
Yeah, dude. Fall guy.
So a lot of good stuff coming up this spring. All right, y'all. Oh, and don't forget to reach out to Cade on Twitter at Cade_Onder and his Gmail at CadeOnder@gmail.com if you've got a job for him. All right, y'all. Peace.
My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.